welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. If you're fighting the Battle of the Bulge, you can take heart in the research of Dr. William Chalmers. His work with substances like ghrelin and neuropeptide Y has uncovered some interesting clues to how the body controls appetite. And Blake Mills of the Alberta Conservation Association is flying the skies, documenting the impact cottagers have on the riparian habitat around Alberta lakes. And Jos Losenberg is experimenting with different reclamation techniques at the SAGD site for Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Last year, I spoke with Dr. William Chalmers about his research at the University of Alberta on neuropeptide Y. While investigating the connection between NPY and epilepsy, he discovered that it also played a role in appetite. That discovery made William a natural choice to work with a team of American researchers who were trying to unlock the mysteries of another appetite-related substance, and that's something called ghrelin. Their research has just been published in the scientific journal Neuron.
This article is the result of a collaboration between a number of groups. The starting point was a hormone called ghrelin, which had been discovered fairly recently in around the year 2000 by a Japanese group. And people rapidly discovered that this hormone was important in causing animals to eat. So it, when you inject it into the bloodstream or if you inject it directly into the brain, animals would eat in a very, very significant fashion. So this caused a great deal of excitement when people found out where it was located, which was in the stomach and in the proximal intestine. It seemed a perfect signal to sense the contents of the stomach or the absence thereof, and when it circulated, it could make you hungry and tell you to eat. So the working idea was that circulating ghrelin got into the brain and acted there and maybe in somewhere else in outside the brain to tell the brain that the body was hungry. Now this was challenged first by my colleague Thomas Horvath, who's the senior author of this paper at Yale. And what Thomas did was take antibodies to ghrelin. So this is a way of localizing ghrelin. And he found, using three different antibodies, that ghrelin was, in fact, in the brain, in nerve cells in the brain. And not just in the brain, but it was found in very interesting areas, regions of the brain that have been shown by a lot of people to be important in energy balance, that is, appetite, energy expenditure, etc. So once we had an idea that ghrelin was, in fact, in the brain in these regions, a number of groups set out to look at where it acted and how it worked. So the first thing that another group did was to look at where ghrelin bound. Now, ghrelin is a hormone, and like any other chemical messenger, it binds to receptors in the bodies. The hormone is like the key, and the receptor is like the lock. So when it binds, it opens the lock and causes something to happen in the cell that has that lock on it. So what the guys at Lilly did, Matthias Chirp and Mark Hyman, was to make a form of ghrelin that was fluorescent, so you could see it. So then they could apply it to sections of the brain and look and see where it bound. And it showed some very pretty pictures of where ghrelin actually bound.
Now, how did you get involved? How does this relate to the work that you were doing with the neuropeptide Y?
Well, it turned out that when they looked at where ghrelin bound, it turned out that it bound to nerve cells that made neuropeptide Y, another chemical messenger. And others had shown that NPY, neuropeptide Y, was important in making animals eat. And we've been following how that works for a number of years. I was called up by Thomas Horvath and asked if I was be interested in pursuing this. And, of course, we said yes. So what we were able to find out was that that ghrelin caused the release of neuropeptide Y, and by doing so, that was probably the most important means of it making animals eat. And our colleague Michael Calley, who'd also worked with us before on neuropeptide Y and other transmitters related to eating, he was able to show that in a very closely related part of the brain, the arcuate nucleus, that ghrelin, in fact, did excite neuropeptide Y neurons, causing the release of neuropeptide Y and other transmitters in the arcuate nucleus. So all of this fit together in a beautiful fashion that ghrelin neurons, triggered by some as-yet-unknown stimulus, release ghrelin. The ghrelin binds to neuropeptide Y-containing neurons in several places, causes the release of neuropeptide Y, and this, in turn, is at least a major component of how ghrelin causes animals to get hungry.
What does it all mean then?
What it tells us is that there are several important players in the body that are signals for telling us that we're hungry. There's neuropeptide Y. There's now ghrelin. There are a couple of other signals as well that tell you that you need to eat. There are relatively few signals that tell you that you have already got enough food on board, and this is part of the current problem with weight control, in that under most circumstances, animals did not evolve in the presence of too much food. So this is what we have now in North America is a unique circumstance, and much of the obesity that results, particularly in the last 30 years, has come about because we just have all this really good food, and our bodies don't really know how to respond to that much good food. So what we're hoping to do is to understand better and better how the brain takes these signals, what signals are important for telling us we're hungry, which signals are important to tell us that we've had enough to eat, and understand better how the brain assesses each of them in its own way, so that we can get a better handle on what's important for the brain and where we can best intervene so that we know when to stop.
Ghrelin, then, is something that every living being has?
It's found in most mammals. I don't know if it's been looked at any lower down than that, but it's important for a number of other things as well as appetite. So it is a natural ligand for another receptor, which causes the release of growth hormone. And growth hormone has been known for a long time to be very important during development, during childhood, to make sure that you reach your maximum height and linear growth, as well as it apparently taking over another role once the animal is grown.
So is it a case that we might have too much ghrelin?
I think it's an interesting question, which has been looked at in some ways. For example, people who have had stomach belly surgery for obesity, the ones that have had the surgery which would tend to remove ghrelin-containing neurons, they not only have lower ghrelin levels, but they also lose weight better. So in humans, it appears to be important in feeding, although there are some paradoxical results. Of course, we can't do the experiments in human hypothalamus that we can do in the rat.
Is this at the point where you could start developing therapies or drugs?
I think it's a little premature to think about a fat blaster pill, but the more we know about these systems, the better off we're going to be. So potentially, yes, of course, drug companies are very interested in this and other players in the brain. Another way to consider it is that it may be very well possible to use markers such as ghrelin levels or what have you in the brain to assess the effects of non-medical treatments such as diet, exercise, or what have you, regulating body weight, so that one could potentially optimize things like diets or things like exercise to assist with medication in helping to normalize body weight.
What's next for you now?
Well, I'd really like to know what these ghrelin neurons are excited and inhibited by. That is, what factors cause ghrelin release in the brain. That's a big question, and I think that's one of the next things that we're going to look at as soon as we can.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. William Chalmers, a professor of pharmacology at the University of Alberta. His work is supported by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. One of the great dreams of many people is to own a cottage at the lake. The unfortunate fact is that most cottage owners end up destroying the very habitat that attracted them to the lake in the first place. Cleaning up the shoreline for swimming and boat launches is just one thing that makes it harder for fish and waterfowl to survive. Blake Mills is the habitat leader for the Alberta Conservation Association in St. Paul, and he's developed a unique approach to saving shorelines in cottage country. Using an ultralight aircraft and digital technology, he's already documented several hundred kilometers of shoreline development on Alberta lakes.
A lot of the shorelines around our lakes have been coming under development pressure for 50, 60, 100 years in this province. Not just from an agricultural sense, certainly, but more in terms of our more popular lakes from human-caused development. They're very attractive places to be. People are drawn to the lake. You know, hey, we're going to the lake for the weekend. Unfortunately, what has happened is that we have not had the opportunity, perhaps, to understand what role we have or responsibility we have when we are living, playing, working in these areas. And these lakes are actually very susceptible to damage. And it's only over the course of time that we're starting to see how we've slowly changed the face of our lakes to stop the proper function of these areas. Like, these shoreline areas provide us as people with all kinds of enjoyment, but they also provide a fundamental biological function to the lake itself. They stabilize the shoreline. They filter nutrients. A properly working shoreline can stop ice from running up through your garage, if you will. There's all sorts of things that area, that shoreline, that green ribbon, if you will, around a lake provides to the lake and provides to us. And our ignorance of that has changed what we often think of as we're making it better. We're going to get rid of all those ugly weeds and clean it up. And what we're doing is we're putting our mindset on what Mother Nature has designed. And unfortunately, a lot of the things that attracted us to the lake in the first place, you know, clean water, wildlife viewing, nice stable shorelines, you know, these sorts of things, we've converted and we're starting to see our lakes change.
Well, the other thing too is that when you go in and you mow down those weeds or the reed beds, it's actually taking away fish habitat too, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And this is part of the interesting thing is a weed is often defined as a plant that grows where you don't want it to. And as soon as you get into the water, that usually means anything that gets stuck between your toes is a weed and is a bad thing. So we feel we have to clean up the lake. We have to help the lake by getting rid of those nasty weeds. But unfortunately, that's the lifeblood of a lot of our fish species. They rely on those areas, especially for spawning, rearing of young fish, protection, thermal cover. All sorts of values, again, are provided by that vegetation that's just offshore. And we have to realize that our actions there are affecting our fish populations. We have only approximately 800 lakes in Alberta that support sport fish. And we have enough anglers to fill Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Alberta again. We have far more people than we have lakes. So when we start removing the ability of those few lakes to produce fish for us, then we really compound the problem.
You've been doing a really interesting study which takes you up in the air in an ultralight plane, and you're a cameraman with a digital camera, and you're looking at these lake shores. What exactly are you doing?
Well, actually, there's two of us that do that. We have an ultralight aircraft. It's called a flex-wing trike. It's If any of your listeners have ever seen the movie Fly Away Home, where they fly the geese south, it sort of looks like a hang glider with an engine, two seats in it. One of us flies and one of us films. And what we do is we focus our camera on that shoreline. We try to capture that shoreline area so that we can take it back and look at it on our TV and look at it on our computer and ask it some questions like, just how healthy is that shoreline? And from that assessment, we're able to determine in a subjective nature, just where our problems are. Where's the good spots? Where's the bad spots? And then what we can do about it. We're able to use all sorts of interesting mapping technologies and geo-referencing and GPS and GIS and a few acronyms I can't even mention to help us understand what is going on so that we can turn that into an action and start helping the people that live, work, and play on those areas what their effect is. So we're actually taking pictures that will help us very quickly get a sense of how healthy a lake is or if it's working properly, but also be able to translate that into information for people so that they can hopefully change or understand what the problems are so that they can change in action to a hopefully more friendly way of doing business.
What I found interesting when you were showing the video is that you could literally pinpoint every single lot or cottage owner and see what each individual was doing and the effect that they were having on the lake. How much of that do you have?
Well, we're working on priority water bodies in Alberta. There's, even though I said there's 800, it still takes a long time to get around even the priority ones. We're in the capture data mode right now. We're capturing that information, and then what we're going to do is build a process, hopefully going to build a process around that to start getting that into the hands of the lot owners, those individual lot owners, so that they can understand what they're doing, but also the agency people out there, the government, not government, the lake conservation groups, those, anybody who can take that information and help people learn from it. And what that's actually what's really been the challenge for us as managers is because even though we may have by numbers a few lakes, we have literally tens of thousands of miles of shoreline, and a large percentage of that is developed to some degree. So as conservation agencies, there's certainly not enough of us to do the job. So we needed a quick, easy way to get the message out, but with a picture. Not just a picture of, Joe Blow's lake. No, a picture of your lake, a picture of your lot, and what your lot looks like compared to the whole lake. So people take ownership. They realize, oh, yeah, that's my lot. I now understand that here's my role. And hopefully they make a change to the better.
What lakes did you get to this summer?
Well, we did a wide variety of lakes, but we tried to pick some of the more developed ones. So we did like Sylvan Lake, Gull Lake, Buck Lake down in the Red Deer, Central Alberta country. We flew a couple of lakes up around St. Paul. We flew Muriel Lake and Hilda Lake. And then west of Edmonton, we did Wabamun, which is a big one, Lac St. Anne, Lachlan on Isle Lake. We wanted to start with some of our bigger lakes so that when we capture this information and we hopefully can start some action on the ground down there, in 3 or 4 years, we can go back and capture the same film again from the same way and compare it and measure change. See, hey, have we made a difference with our on-the-ground activities? Is there a way that we can say, yeah, this worked? And that's what we've needed, is that literally an eye in the sky thing. And it's the ability to collect that information in an inexpensive format, inexpensive way, using this ultralight aircraft and a camera, but also the ability to repeat it again. And that's the real key thing, is to follow up on it.
Well, just looking at Sylvan Lake, which you flew this summer and filmed, what did you find there in terms of the health or the unhealth and the types of structures that are on the lakeshore?
Well, it's Sylvan Lake, and it's kind of indicative of all the lakes down in that neck of the woods. There was a lot of cottage development and a lot of docks and these sorts of things. So we tried to capture some of that information to give us a sense of what the percentage of good shoreline and maybe not so good shoreline and really not so good shoreline was, so that we could come up with some kind of ideas. And I think the numbers were in the neighborhood of about 53% of the shoreline was healthy or pretty healthy, and about 30-35% was pretty healthy, but it had some problems. Something wasn't quite right, and about 15% was just wasn't working. It just wasn't doing what it was supposed to do. So very quickly we were able to get a big idea as to what the general health of that 23 miles of shoreline was. And that allows people all kinds of options. If they're looking at putting in other marinas or other developments, they can stop and ask themselves and say, hey, 53% of our lake is healthy. Is that enough? or maybe it's too much. It allows people very quickly to get a sense of that. And the same thing came with like just counting docks. I was just curious how many docks were around there. So I counted about 415 docks. That can be used for a whole myriad of folks because, well, okay, one dock times perhaps two boats times this sort of thing. You're able to get some sense of use on the lake. Boat traffic has been correlated to loss of habitat in some places. So there's all kinds of information that you can answer by watching a movie, quite simply.
Thank you very much, Blake.
You're very welcome.
That was Blake Mills of the Alberta Conservation Association. He's the habitat leader with the ACA's Northeast Business Unit in St. Paul. Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited is one of the companies experimenting with steam technology to recover bitumen from the oil sands deposits near Fort McMurray. And like those other companies, the JCOS lease is also on the forest management area for Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. Constructing the well sites means removing soil that supports the forest. Jos Lossenberg looks after environmental affairs for JCOS. One of the areas he's researching is better reclamation techniques for the company's hanging stone site.
Our facility south of McMurray is referred to as a demonstration project, which is to try and demonstrate SAGD technology, which is steam-assisted gravity drainage. We have 8 well pairs that have all been drilled over the last 3 or 4 years. Where in each sort of phase of the project, we're trying slightly different things in terms of well completion and the length of the horizontal leg on the well, all with a view to determining what's the best strategy for recovering the bitumen.
One of the things that JCOS has done has entered into an agreement with ALPAC because where you're doing your operation is on ALPAC's FMA, and so there's disturbance to the forest. What are the issues that you're working on together in terms of putting the forest back once you're finished?
Well, the type of issues that we're working on are, of course, the entire concept of integrated landscape management, which in essence involves minimizing disturbance by ensuring that any other operators or activities in the area are harmonized. The other thing that we're doing is we are practicing constraints mapping, where what we do is when we're proposing to disturb some land that we try and take into account any particularly unique environmental features and avoid some of those features. And then, of course, the third aspect of it is something that's becoming very prevalent now in the area is practicing low-impact seismic, where instead of the old 6-meter-wide, sometimes even 8-meter-wide seismic lines, we go to, in many cases, 3 and sometimes even less, sometimes down to as little as, I think it's 1.8 meters. And those are sort of the three broad principles that we're trying to practice right now. And, of course, ALPAC has its own forestry operations, and the intent is that we harmonize our disturbance activities with their planned harvesting activities. In our case, however, that doesn't really apply very directly because the area was burned over by a major forest fire in 1995. And furthermore, that probably somewhere between 40 and 50% of the landscape is muskeg, which means that from a forestry harvesting point of view, it's not that productive. Nevertheless, ALPAC has been extremely useful in the sense that they are often the only group that are aware of all the activities that might be taking place in the area. So talking with ALPAC makes us aware of some potential conflicts with other operators or other activities.
What are some of the things that you're experimenting with at this time?
I guess a lot of what we're trying to do is to practice accelerated reclamation. One of the things that we have at our site is because our particular operations were predated by some other operations out there. And so we've had an opportunity to observe some of the older well sites that were constructed and put in 12, 15 years ago. And what strikes you when you look at a lot of these well sites is that they were typically reseeded with grass, and that even after 15 years, they're still predominantly grass. And although there's indication that the forest is reclaiming itself at the edges, nevertheless, pasture land in the middle of the boreal forest is not a natural phenomenon. So the objective from a reclamation point of view, and a realization on the part of many, is that if we can take some of these well sites with which we're finished and put them back into a productive forest-type environment more quickly, then ultimately we will shorten the temporal disturbance in the landscape.
So what are you doing then so that you get away from this idea of just planting grass and leaving pastures all over the place in the middle of your lease?
What we're trying to do is we're trying to play with a variety of soil amelioration techniques that will promote the growth of species that we would normally find in the boreal forest. It's entirely an open question whether or not the bare subsoil that we have at the moment is actually capable of sustaining shrubs and trees. And part of the experiment is to essentially create a number of different environments to determine whether bare subsoil will grow trees, whether that bare subsoil needs to be ameliorated with some peat, or whether wood chips or any other woody debris would work as well. The purpose of what we're trying to do is to sort of come up with the ideal recipe for the environment that we're in that will allow for an environment that's natural to the area.
Where are you at in terms of those experiments or those recipes?
We're still in the early days. We have done some work here with by adding peat to some of these subsoils. We're looking at mulching and chipping some of the woody debris that is left behind naturally as part of the original clearing exercise. And the next step is to actually plant these sites with trees and shrubs and to monitor their growth or success.
When do you expect to get some results from the reclamation experiment?
I would expect that within about 2 to 3 years' time, we'll have a fairly good indication as to the kind of trees and shrubs that take and those that don't in various different conditions. And then I think the next step will be to adjust the remainder of our reclamation efforts to reflect what we've learned. And there may be another cycle that we would go through of approximately 2 or 3 years. But so in other words, total probably 5-6 years, and we'll have a fairly good idea as to the success of some of our initiatives.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Glad you could come.
That was Jos Lossenberg, the Senior Environmental Coordinator for Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Conservation Association, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Sustainable Forest Management Network, the Capital Region Innovation Center, Alberta Research Council, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Alberta Ingenuity Fund, the University of Lethbridge, True North Energy, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.